Okay, so the Great Depression in New South Wales was a period of intense class confrontation. Workers in their hundreds and in their thousands participated in bitter strikes, riots, and protests against the deprivations of the economic crash. And a significant layer of those workers radicalized politically. So a lot of discussions on the Great Depression, very rightfully, focus on the militancy of communist and socialist activists in the period, such as the Dole strikes, the anti-eviction protests, and the rebuilding of the unions through the militant minority movement. I'm going to hopefully touch on some of those features, but I really want to focus in this talk mainly on the left organisations in New South Wales that formed or grew during the Great Depression and how they interacted with each other. Because I want to argue that there's a lot of heroism that goes on in the organising in the Great Depression against the horrors of that economic crash. But the early 30s in New South Wales in particular, but across Australia, I think really represents a pretty tragic missed opportunity to build a mass socialist workers' party in a moment where tens of thousands of left-wing workers were moving rapidly leftwards. So thousands of workers in New South Wales saw the financial crash of 1929 as the final indictment of capitalism. And they joined a range of political organisations, not only to struggle around the immediate crisis decimating their living standards, they were looking for a strategy to end the system. They joined political parties, factions, and campaign groups, which not only offered an explanation for the capitalist roots of the crisis, but also put forward strategies to fight for socialism in their lifetime. And the most important of these were the Communist Party of Australia, the left of Lang's Labor Party, and in particular, the socialisation units initiated by New South Wales Labor. So the Great Depression hit Australia hard and it hit it early. While the Wall Street crash came in 1929, in Australia, the economy really started to go into decline earlier in 1928. So by the time the global impact of the crash started to be felt at the end of 1929, Australia had already contracted its GDP by 6.2%. So by 1929, the bosses' offensive had already been raging for a year. Bosses were determined to restore profitability by smashing up conditions and the unions which had won them. And the Great Depression began with three enormous defeats for workers and their unions. The trade union bureaucracy was not politically prepared to stand up to the intensity of the onslaught. So at the end of 1928, waterside workers went on strike in opposition to the Transport Workers Act. This was a massive attack initiated by the nationalist government with the intention of wiping the union off the docks altogether. The Act basically gave the federal government the power to set licenses for waterside workers in order for them to work on the docks. So this piece of union busting bastardry was dubbed the dog collar. This is the picture of one of the licenses that were issued to waterside workers at the time. And it was called the dog collar by strikers who could see it was designed to restrain militancy in order to push down wages. So after a bloody and bitter campaign, the waterside workers were crushed. And this was followed really rapidly by the timber workers, who were opposing the arbitration court's decision to extend their week from 44 hours to 48 hours. And this is a picture of 7,000 timber workers protesting outside of Darlinghurst Court. And their comrades are inside, and they're being sentenced for non-compliance with the award. And after 9 months of a battle by the timber workers, they too went down to defeat. Finally, in March 1929, the coal miners in the Northern District collieries of New South Wales were locked out of their workplaces by the bosses. And this was in the middle of negotiations with their union. So the bosses were demanding a pay cut, and their plan was to starve the 10,000 miners and their families into submission. And the bosses were confident that the union leadership would not turn the tables on them and retaliate by closing down the southern collieries during an economic downturn. And sadly, despite the Communist Party's opposition, the bosses were right. They refused to extend the lockout. So all of these three struggles were defensive and lost. They were initiated or supported by the arbitration courts and the legislation of a self-confident conservative government. They were backed up by the captains of industry, united in their resolve to squeeze back some of their declining profits by crushing unions. And those bosses were confident that high unemployment would weaken workers' solidarity and bargaining power. So each of these defeated struggles involved serious capitulation from a trade union bureaucracy, which was totally spooked by the stakes of the struggle, spooked by the levels of unemployment and the resolve of the courts, the bosses and the government. Cue the Labor Party. So when the federal election was called in 1929, workers had been defeated on the industrial field, or were in the middle of futile standoffs that looked like they were ready to go down to defeat, like the Northern coal lockout. The union officials looked to the election of Labor as the only solution to their industrial weakness. And the coming election was also an excuse for their feebleness in the face of the bosses' offensive. Labor under Scullin was put in government in a landslide election in 1929, the highest Labor vote in the party's history. Labor's victory was so triumphant that the nationalist PM before them, Stanley Bruce, lost his own seat in the election, and he's the only prime minister to do so until John Howard lost his seat in 2007 off the back of work choices. So Scullin was elected in 1929, promising to end the Northern New South Wales coal lockout. The traditional Conservative Party in government for 13 years was in tatters, creating a vacuum on the right, and one that would actually not be totally filled until the formation of the Menzies Liberal Party in 1944. So totally in chaos. And class questions had been at the heart of the election. The controversy of the union busting on the waterfront had actually been the thing that triggered the election. And the union leadership had gone all in for Labor. It was their only strategy. The Miners Federation had raised £1,000, which is nothing to be sneezed at the time, for the election of a Labor government. And Scullin's election posters across New South Wales said, vote Labor and open the mines, vote Labor and prosecute John Brown, who was the coal baron responsible for the lockout, so John Brown to jail. So Scullin took office in October 1929. By December, it was clear that his promises were totally worthless. So in December, 4,000 unionists marched on the Rossbury New South Wales colliery in a bid to force the lockout to an end. And they were faced with police who opened fire. Coal miner Norman Brown was shot dead. And the Northern coal lockout dragged on into 1930, a violent testament to Labor's betrayal. And here pictured is an image of the shooting at the Rossbury coal mine and footage of the workers that came in protest to the funeral of the slain Norman Brown. So not only was Scullin refusing to intervene in favour of workers in industrial disputes, but now his government was the one implementing austerity. And much like the Social Democrats of our own time, like PASOK, Syriza, or the Spanish Socialist Party after the global financial crisis, Scullin accepted that in the face of economic collapse, investor confidence and profits needed to be restored. To do that, he was preparing to push through a 20% cut to public expenditure across the board so the government could meet its debt obligation. So Scullin fully accepted the need for the government to rein in spending and pay back the debt to the banks. And initially, all the premiers, including Jack Lang, pictured here, sometimes known as the big fella, initially Jack Lang also went along with this. When British representative for the London banks, Sir Otto Niemeyer, visit Australia, all the state premiers signed up to what became known as the Premier's Plan, including Lang. And this meant a deflationary policy and 20% cut to government spending achieved by cutting wages, pensions and welfare. So Jack Lang had already been Premier once before in 1925, and he was a pretty standard Labor Premier at that. But when Lang was re-elected in 1930 in New South Wales, anger at the federal Scullin government had already set in. And this was especially bitter in New South Wales as the final defeat of the locked out Northern coal miners came to a close. Lang faced a choice. He could follow Scullin into unpopularity and defeat by implementing a full program of austerity, or he could put himself at the head of the already growing opposition to the Premier's plan and try to renegotiate a compromise. So Lang came out against the plan. And this move led Scullin to dramatically expel Lang from the ALP. almost the entire New South Wales apparatus of the party, the state MPs, some federal New South Wales MPs as well, the unions and branches all followed Lang. The fact that the structures of the New South Wales party are split with Lang demonstrates the depth of the crisis for Labor. And I think it demonstrates that this left jag was driven by pressure from below. Such was the level of anger at Scullin's betrayal, and the union officialdom and parliamentarians in New South Wales recognised that their own careers would be on the line if they couldn't extract some concessions for their working class base. So a week after his expulsion by Scullin, Lang was addressing a monster demonstration of 100,000 supporters in the Domain. 9 months after his expulsion, amid factional strife, Scullin would be defeated in a snap election, this time a landslide against him. So who's Lang? Lang, or the big fella as he was known, is a pretty interesting figure. He was very viciously anti-communist, he's a left nationalist, and he was backed by the left trade union officials, including notorious ex-communists like Jock Garden, often known as the New South Wales Trades Hall Reds. The union officials' votes were essential to Lang's control of the New South Wales apparatus. And Lang was a populist figure. So his brand of populism was a current within Labor ideology, which focused on the banks and the British bondholders as the oppressors of the Australian people. So Australian workers and pastoralists alike. Lang popularised a reform populist worldview, which could be savagely oppositional to betrayers of the nation, while supportive of Aussie capitalists. So Lang had lived through the earlier bankers' crash of the 1890s, when Labor left ideologues, largely blamed the stranglehold which private interests, particularly the City of London bankers, had over Australian credit for the crash. So the 1890s made a reformist obsession with setting up central banks really popular. So where the idea was that governments could have better access to credit and control over it and wouldn't be beholden to private banks. And this is where actually the Commonwealth Bank gets its start. So among Labor left activists, there was an obsession with nationalising the banking system as the reform panacea for solving capitalism's tendency for crisis. And for populists like Jack Lang, opposition to the British banks was a perfect propaganda argument that could both channel a class hostility to the rich while reconciling Labor supporters with the necessity of the capitalist system. So the problem, after all, was not the capitalist system, was not the patriotic industrialists or pastoralists. They were also suffering under the monopoly of the real evil, the money power in London. And this is a picture of a cartoon that was very popular at the time of the kind of long arms of the Bank of England stretching to Australia to strangle the Australian nation. So this was a bold form of populism, which would not have been as confrontational without immense pressure from below. So it was the intense class struggle at the base of Labor which pressured Lang to put forward his program to repudiate some of the debts, or refuse to pay some of the debt the state government owed to British banks. And this move was immensely popular. Lang's factional supporters and the ever-loyal Labor Daily newspaper popularised slogans like Lang is right, Lang is greater than Lenin, and even manufactured plaster busts of the big fella to be displayed proudly on the mantelpiece of his factional supporters. To give an idea of kind of Lang's rhetorical radicalism, before his election, which was in 1930, and kind of in the midst of the defeat of the Northern Lockout, Lang really built his cred by calling on the Federal Labor Party to send the army in to the northern coal mines to break up the bosses' strike and to get the unionists back at work. So he had a real knack for rhetorical militancy while also simultaneously denouncing those to the left of him, both in and outside the party. So why could the ALP channel a form of left populism, which put it at odds with much of the ruling class? And the ruling class really hated Lang. I guess the Labor Party is what Marxists call a bourgeois workers' party. So bourgeois in the sense that it is thoroughly committed to the rule of capitalism, but a workers' party, not just in the sense that workers vote for it, but a workers' party in the sense that it's structurally tied to the organised working class through the trade union bureaucracy. And the ALP was set up by the trade union bureaucracy and very much was instrumental in Lang's control over the party in the 30s. The union officials and the parliamentarians wield the real power in Labour, not the rank and file. Union officials have a thoroughly reformist outlook, playing the role of managers of discontent, arbitrating between workers and capital, ultimately in favour of the system. But in times of intense class struggle, when rank and file workers are rebelling, managing discontent requires talking left, getting to the head of a movement and steering it within acceptable channels. And I think Lang is a really good example of this role that sometimes the Australian Labor Party can play. So he balanced unleashing just enough rhetorical radicalism to maintain power in New South Wales while repressing the radical left inside and outside Labor. Okay, so now onto the Communist Party. The main potential alternative to Labor at this time was the Communist Party of Australia. And by 1930, they had started to build up significant influence amongst a minority of more militant working class activists. In particular, the CPA Unemployed Workers Movement, which initiated defiant actions around the dole and opposing evictions, had started to win back some confidence amongst militants, particularly after the initial wave of defeats. The CPA's rank and file intervention into the union movement was central in rebuilding the unions, which had been gutted at the onset of the Great Depression. But while the Communist Party had been founded as a genuinely revolutionary party in 1920, by the 1930s, it was thoroughly Stalinized. And it's not just that the party was uncritically defended the horrors of state capitalism in Russia, or that it identified socialism with nationalized industry rather than democratic workers' control over production. That is obviously true. But when I say it's Stalinized, the domestic policy of the party was also totally subordinated to the twists and turns of the USSR's foreign policy. So what the Comintern determined was the political line on the ground in Australia. And the CPA's leadership was disciplined to carry this through. So at the end of 1929, the Comintern stepped in to kick yesterday's yes man, Jack Kavanagh, out of the leadership of the party for his right deviationist tendencies towards the ALP. And this was because the Communist Parties of the world had now entered what became known as their third period. So these are a few articles to give you an idea of like the intense sectarianism of the third period. These are a couple of headlines from CPA papers. The third period was a perspective was that global capitalism had now entered its final period of crisis. The time for United Front struggle alongside Social Democrats was over. In fact, the Social Democrats, like Labour in Australia or the SPD in Germany, were now social fascists, objectively the left wing of fascism. And to work with them was to give cover to fascism. So instead, the Communist Parties needed to strike out on their own, denounce all reformists and refuse to engage in joint work with them. And this sectarian line actually had its appeal in Australia as it did in other countries. So after all, Scullin was in government overseeing a savage austerity agenda on behalf of the bosses. Jack Lang was very much a demagogue, appealing to workers' hostility to the banks one day and expelling socialist members from the Labor Party the next. But I think you have to say the crisis in the Australian Labor Party could have been the perfect opportunity for a genuinely revolutionary Communist Party to build a radical alternative to Labor. They could have recruited and won disaffected Labor members in their thousands whose illusions in the parliamentary road to socialism were rapidly being shattered. And the CPA did grow in spite of its own sectarianism. But when a serious left emerged within the New South Wales Labor Party, the CPA was totally incapable of relating to it and really had no interest in relating to it. Despite the disaster of their sectarian approach, though, CPA militants played a leading role in rebuilding working class militancy. And I don't really have time to do justice to the militant minority movement, for example, which was their rank and file strategy, rebuilding unions from the shop floor up and, you know, challenging the conservatism of the trade union bureaucracy. But we have, you know, many talks where we've kind of explored this before. But to give a bit of a summary of what their approach was, our CPA militant Tom Wright described their strategy as winning the leadership of the workers, independent of the reformist bureaucracy and based on rank and file organisation. The militant minority included rank and file Communist Party members and their sympathisers, and any unionist who rejected the failure of arbitration and the conservatism of union officials in favour of a class war perspective. But I think despite that kind of heroism of that rebuilding effort, particularly in some of the first in the coal mines and then in some very important industries, overall their political strategy in this period was extreme sectarianism. Okay. Well, one of the difficulties for Lang was that much of his own base sincerely believed his radical rhetoric, but they weren't happy to simply repudiate some of the debt. They wanted to repudiate the system. The rank and file of the New South Wales Labor Party was in flux. There was a left in the party which advocated a confused form of gradualist socialism and had done since, you know, in the 20s as well. And in the 20s, this left had won a minor victory by introducing the socialist objective into the party program. And this was a concession that the right had allowed with the aim of pacifying the left with empty rhetoric. But in the minds of left activists, it had committed their party to the socialisation of industry as a goal to be pursued in their lifetime. And this socialisation objective took on a new meaning in the tumultuous conditions of the early 30s. Lang actually supported the motion at the New South Wales Party Conference in 1930 to set up a committee based upon the socialism in our time movement inside the party. Now the Labor rank and file had a mandate to set up hundreds of forums within the party to debate out the strategy necessary to abolish private property, and that's what they did. So the committee appealed to Labor branches and unions to set up socialisation propaganda units, and within that year, hundreds of such units were set up across the country. So over the course of the movement, 178 out of 250 Labor branches would set up socialisation units across New South Wales. And a newspaper, Socialisation Call, was established, which claimed to have a circulation of 40,000. And this is a cartoon pretty typical of the Socialisation Call in the early 30s. So the socialisation units wanted socialism in their lifetime. But what did socialism mean for them? It was a pretty confused and, amorphous collection of politics, but there was a general enthusiasm for the abolition of private ownership over industry among Labor members, and a conviction that capitalism was the source of the economic crisis of the Great Depression. The units represented a leftward moving reformism, and overwhelmingly they had as their goal the socialisation of industry by a Labor government, so socialism from above. The units also had a fairly passive approach that emphasised the inevitability of capitalism's contradictions leading to its destruction. So they saw their role as convincing workers of the need to socialise industry, dispelling right-wing myths about socialism, which they thought was ideology, was kind of one of the main barriers, and winning factional battles within Labor to force the politicians to implement their program. And one of their major weaknesses was a lack of orientation to class struggle. So the socialisation units were largely propagandistic rather than actually organising struggle. So they did organise hundreds of educational public meetings, leafleting, produce their newspaper, raise funds, set up discussion groups, and even arrange for a prominent leader to deliver lectures via radio, which they would then go and have discussion groups of afterwards. So pretty innovative for the 20s. But while many socialisation activists participated in union and movement direct action, there was little coordination between the socialisation units and the struggles of the times, either in the unions or in the unemployed movement. It started to be towards the end of the movement, but this was an early weakness. At the Labor Conference of 1931 in New South Wales, Bill McNamara, the movement secretary, moved a motion for the Labor Party to take to the next election a commitment to implement socialism within 3 years through government regulation. So the next day, Lang's inner group faction pushed not to overturn the motion, but to amend it to the point of total meaninglessness so that it would have no prescriptive directions for the government. And this was pretty typical of the movement being really kind of caught up in what were pretty just rhetorical battles within the Labor Party. I think it is important, though, to emphasise that there was an internal development of the socialisation unit's politics that started to shift it massively to the left under the impact of the Depression and also Jack Lang's growing hostility to the units. And it was an open-ended question how independent from Labor the socialisation units were willing to be. So from the beginning, there were debates about who could join them and if you needed to be a Labor member, and lots of people just joined Labor so they could be a part of this movement and hadn't been before, and if you could be a member of any communist-aligned campaign groups like the Unemployed Workers Movement, which Lang was very hostile to. So who could and couldn't be a member was often the terrain of the debate about what the socialisation movement should do, what its attitude was to direct action, electoralism and the struggles of the day. Was it simply an educational wing of the Labor Party's electoral machine, or should it be connected up with CPA in dominated campaign groups and be involved in on-the-ground struggle? So there's a growing awareness amongst the socialisation unit leaders that the capitalist class doesn't simply rule through its ideological dominance, but through control over the state. And Scullin's betrayal in federal government pointed towards the need to go beyond reformism. In 1931, the Socialisation Committee released the Payne Report, produced by former CPA member Tom Payne, which called for the socialisation of industry through revolution and said that you could not achieve this through electoralism. While this report was rejected by the Socialisation Committee leadership, it does show the ideological flux within the units. By 1932, it was clear the units presented a challenge to Lang's inner group faction of supporters, the parliamentarians and upper echelons of union officials that backed him. And amid the backdrop of Lang's dismissal, spoilers, he's going to get ousted, a factional battle broke out over the soul of New South Wales Labor Party. And because the units saw themselves as working to push Langism leftwards, they were pretty disarmed when they came under attack from Lang and his inner group faction seriously. The Lang-aligned Labor Daily newspaper ran a vicious campaign against the socialisation movement and its most high-profile supporters, and a bitter battle for control over the party broke out in every branch, at every conference and in every committee. Well, I just want to take a turn to look at what's going on in the right of society now. So Labor was splitting between moderate backers of austerity, Scullin government, supporters of Lang repudiating the debt, and Labor radicals who were calling for the socialisation of industry. While that was going on, the forces on the right were in chaos. The Nationalist Party was blown apart, and respectable conservative figures were reconstituting themselves electorally in the United Australia Party. So this is a picture of one of the kind of electoral posters of the United Australia Party, very preoccupied with the communist menace. That was actually just the mainstream conservative party, not the far right. So while, this kind of crisis on the right is going on, you know, radicalisation on the left, fascism was growing its forces in Europe in the wake of the social crisis there. And in Australia in the 1930s, it would give rise to a mass fascist movement with two faces, the old guard and the new guard. The old guard was a secretive organisation which included captains of industry like the chair of the AMP and the general manager of the Colonial Sugar Refinery, CSR. And they wanted Lang out through constitutional manoeuvres if possible, but through violent confrontation if necessary. The new guard, a more radical version, was a split from the old guard which split off in order to organise openly and not secretively. And it was initiated by impatient elements who did not want to wait to initiate a move against Lang, but wanted to act against the communist threat immediately. And it modelled itself explicitly on Mussolini's brown shirts and was much more ideologically, openly fascist and propagandistic. So while a fascist regime was never an imminent threat in the 1930s in Australia, nothing like the situation in Europe, the popularity of counter-revolutionary preparations by the ruling class gives you a sense of the polarisation of the time. So this is some images of New Guard activists that might be quite famous. Francis de Groot, who was famously arrested cutting the ribbon on the Sydney Harbour Bridge in 1932 before Lang could. And this is New Guard leader Eric Campbell sig-heiling. Typical of this layer, the new guard, was Dr. Ennie Kirkwood, who was grandson of a pastoralist mine owner, president of the RSL Club, and later the Rotary Club of Wollongong. And these are very respectable figures in society that were won to fascism. Or J.P. Caddy, general manager of the Port Kembla Steel and Ironworks, and local Boy Scouts master. So these distinguished men had the fear of God put in them by rising working class militancy, and it led them to fantasize about a fascist movement that could clean the streets of the unemployed and the communists and get rid of Lang. So after the defeat of Scullin, the incoming conservative government made moves against Lang. This is a picture of Jack Lang and Sir Philip Game, the governor of New South Wales. So an anti-communist hysteria was whipped up at the beginning, at the same time as Lang was purging the left of his own base. So the federal government launched a legal campaign to prosecute Lang for repudiating the debt, and a standoff began to emerge between the federal government and Lang. In dramatic scenes, Lang withdrew money from the government bank accounts in order to not pay it, and held it in cash in Trades Hall. And some members of the ruling class, if you read their diaries of the time, like genuinely believed a civil war between the federal government and the state government was imminent, which is crazy. It definitely wasn't. But, you know, some examples were Lang was getting the police of New South Wales, who were actually very loyal to him throughout this whole crisis, to do kind of drill marches in Sydney, at the same time as the very paranoid federal government had the army just precautionarily do some manoeuvres just outside of Canberra city, because there were kind of hysterical visions of masses of Lang supporting unemployed people marching from Sydney onto the bush capital. So in a move which would prefigure the curfew against Gough Whitlam many decades later, the governor of New South Wales, Sir Philip Game, would dismiss Jack Lang from government on the 13th of May 1932. And this is both of the figures. I actually found out Sir Philip Games also was the cop in London who broke up Cable Street. So he has quite a distinguished record for his far-right actions. So despite Lang's radical rhetoric and symbolic acts of defiance, Lang had no intention of mounting a confrontation with the federal government, let alone the institutions of capitalism. And despite hysterical accusations that he was preparing red militias to fight the coup, in practice, Lang immediately accepted the terrain of the election by the caretaker government that was put in place. So what, like Whitlam in 1975, Lang was more concerned at keeping his supporters within the terrain of electoralism and keeping control over the party than he was with stopping the coup. And how did, this is some pictures of mass protests against the sacking that took place. But how did the Communist Party respond? Because Lang and the socialisation units were considered the left wing of fascism in the minds of third period Stalinists, the Communist Party felt no obligation to mobilise working class resistance to this obvious attack from the right. Throughout the dismissal, rather than opposing the mobilisation of the governor, the federal government, the army and the far right to bring down the Labor government, the Communist Party denounced Labor supporters with a plague on both your houses attitude. And this was absolutely criminal. So it's the equivalent in 1975 of the far left stepping aside during the curfew and refusing to oppose the dismissal on the grounds that Whitlam was a reformist. So Lang had no intention of mobilising supporters to oppose the coup beyond the usual election rallies. But this could have been an opportunity for a mass socialist party to engage in united front work with socialisation unit members and Labor left activists to rely on the self-activity of workers to fight the coup and the imposition of austerity and go beyond Langism and electoralism. So far from trying to relate to these disillusioned reformists, the CPA press denounced them as social fascists, particularly the socialisation units, while the Lang-aligned daily Labor newspaper denounced them as crypto-communists. And just to start, this is some of the Communist Party's newspaper, just to start to talk about the end of the socialisation units. So when Lang moved to drive the socialisation units out of the party in 32, he did it by adopting some of the movement's militant language. So instead of calling for the socialisation of industry, he put forward the vague demand to socialise credit. In 1933, the socialisation movement suffered a major defeat at the Easter Party conference. And this is a picture of, will there be yet another Easter crucifixion? So they were defeated 4-1 by Lang's faction. After the defeat at the Easter conference, the socialisation forces called a rank and file conference of around 200 at a hall owned by the Boot Trades Union. And the movement activists were divided and demoralised. A revolutionary grouping wanted to form a new industrial labour party, while most of the leading members called for activists to remain in the party. One of the few politicians who was a backer of the socialisation movement, Clary Martin, said, "In general, we have arrived at the conclusion that we should work within the party, that to form a separate party would be suicide, though we find it difficult to suggest the appropriate machinery to maintain our socialisation work. There is said to be a strong body of opinion for a breakaway, and we will have difficulty restraining them." I'm really reminded when you read the kind of end of the socialisation units of the remnants of Corbynism today, clinging to the British Labour Party, even as Starmer hounds leftists out of the party. Yeah, and it's just a tragedy that there wasn't a mass revolutionary party that wasn't Stalinist there to actually relate to these reformists as they were being driven out by Lang. So I think one thing to wrap up that the Great Depression demonstrates is that Australia is far from the lucky country of easygoing egalitarianism. It has been a country racked with radical class confrontations. And the Great Depression led to political polarisation, the rise of a fascistic far right in ruling class circles, and violent class struggle. As Marxists, we know that crises like the Great Depression are baked into capitalism. Australia is not a lucky country permanently immune from economic collapse. And the Labor Party in any future crisis, I expect, will probably be more likely to behave like Scullin, loyally implementing austerity. But reformist leaders in the future will once again shift to the left like Lang, channeling working class aspirations while leading them into a dead end. And I think we want to both celebrate the heroism of the socialist and communist activists that defied the bosses' offensive, rebuilt the unions, struggled around the dole. But I think we also want to learn again about from the limitations of that period so that next time round we're prepared to build a mass revolutionary socialist workers' party. And I'll leave it there.